When Mary Taylor Peverty was 9 years old, she was a girl guide doing what girl guides do, singing songs at troop meetings, earning badges and doing her best to live up to the guide pledge. But Mary's troop wasn't in the suburbs. Mary was a girl guide at a Japanese prisoner of war camp in China. She and her siblings were attending a boarding school in China. The day after the Pearl Harbor attack in 1941, the Japanese sent the teachers, students and staff to a prison camp. The adults started a girl guides troop in the camp and gave Mary and her friends a tiny piece of their childhoods. In just a few weeks, Mary will celebrate the 70th anniversary of the liberation of that camp. Mary Peverty is on the line with us now from New Jersey. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you so much.
And it's so good to have you on the program. This is such an amazing story.
Well, it is amazing to me when I never thought I would actually find all seven of the Americans and one Chinese interpreter who liberated the concentration camp, and to imagine that I recently found the last of the seven, it's a miracle story.
We're going to talk about that rescue and the individuals involved in that shortly, but first, let's get a bit of background. What were you and your family doing in China at that time?
I'm the daughter of missionaries. I and my siblings were born in China to my parents. My parents were third generation. My father was third generation missionaries in China. So we were there when the Japanese started invading into China, gobbling chunk by chunk.
Did you know they were coming? In fact, how much advance warning did you have?
Well, we knew they were coming because they had marched into the central part of China where my parents were having doing missionary work in a walled compound, and it was a very dangerous situation because many of the Chinese will still tell you about the rape of Nanking. My father had opened up the missionary compound to 1,000 women and children when the Japanese marched into the city. So we knew there was a war going on, but it really wasn't our war. It was a war with China, and we did not expect it to involve, certainly not a school for the children of missionaries. I mean, we were there serving, our parents were there serving God. We were there in the coast of China in a school for the children of missionaries. So in a country where people speak Chinese, if we wanted to have an English language education, we went to the Chifu school that educated the children of missionaries.
Did anyone have any idea what the Japanese military were like? Was there advanced knowledge of the way they operated, the attitudes they had, and the likely outcome of their arrival?
Absolutely. My mother was American. My father was British, born in Glasgow, Scotland. And my mother had been hit over the head a couple of times with a stick when she didn't follow the Japanese rule fast enough in this central China province. The rule was you get off your bicycle and you bow to the Japanese, and she hadn't gotten off her bicycle fast enough, and she'd been hit over the head with a stick. And that was when my parents decided they would take a breather and go to the coast of China to be with, I had a brother and sister already at the Chifu school. So that brought us together right there, and the Japanese were in the harbor. The gunboats were in the harbor, shelling into the hills beyond the school at nighttime against Chinese guerrillas that were fighting against them.
How do you explain their aggressiveness? Have you thought much about that?
Well, you've got to remember that I was a child, and I'm looking at my view of this whole story is the view of a child.
Yeah.
And the grown-ups were protecting us, so...
Well, the reason I ask that is because, you know, as the story unfolds, you realize, I mean, the way that they treated people was horrible, and I just wonder what motivates people to treat others like that.
Well, we didn't see them treating... We children did not see the Japanese treating anybody in a difficult, a harsh way. I'm not saying that they didn't. We didn't see it, except we would see the Chinese, the guerrillas that had been shelled the night before, walking down bandaged up with their bloodied bandages down Mule Road behind our house there at the coast of China. This was, of course, before the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. So we knew that they could be dangerous, but we were protected by the grown-ups.
They obviously, though, had a sense of superiority, and that extended to their attitude to Westerners as well as Chinese.
I think there's no question that they did, because when the war was declared, they appeared on the doorstep of our school, and a Japanese Shinto priest came to the ball field and did a ceremony that said this school now belonged to the great emperor of Japan. And it wasn't very long. They went right from bedroom and classroom to all the rooms, putting seals on all property, saying this in Japanese writing, saying it now belonged to the great emperor of Japan. And that was when we got the seals. Well, they didn't tattoo us, but we had to wear an armband to indicate our nationality, A, for American, B, for British. And if we left the campus of the school, we had to wear the armband. And we children would watch the Japanese practicing bayonet drills. I mean, this is really what we're saying, is children watching Japanese practice killing each other with bayonets. Of course, we called it yaw practice, because the two guards that would be attacking each other would be screaming yaw as they charged. And, of course, they were suited up to protect them. But this was what we started with when the Japanese took over our school.
So what happened in terms of everyone being rounded up and put into the camp? Describe the camp. What were you trucked into it, were you?
Well, when we were first, the first camp was a small camp in the very same city where our school had been located. The Japanese said they wanted our school for a Japanese naval base, and they marched us across the city to a Presbyterian missionary compound, and that was very, very crowded. And we stayed there about a year until they shipped us. They shipped us and then put by train and then by truck, like animals in a truck, to the Weishien concentration camp, where we ended up with 1,500 Allied prisoners there, all rounded up from North China, in the Weishien concentration camp.
You mentioned that, you know, you were a child at the time. What are your memories then of that happening? Were you conscious at the age of nine that this wasn't too good? And were the adults, you know, showing on their faces that this was a very bad situation?
My parents, God-fearing people, said, no matter what comes, what you do to protect children is you pour God's promises into their heart. And my mother put to music the beautiful words of Psalm 91, and included in Psalm 91, while we, the little Taylor Choir, would sing around the old-fashioned pump organ every day at our family worship after breakfast, and that beautiful words come in the psalm, and he shall give his angels charge over you to keep you. And we believed that God was going to give his angels charge over to keep us. And the same thing happened in the Chifu school. When we were marched off to concentration camp, I can still remember that vividly, the day they marched us out of our compound to go to concentration camp, and the whole school began singing from the Psalms, God is our refuge and our strength. And on it goes, he will take care of us in trouble. We will not be afraid. And so there we were, marching into concentration camp, singing from the Psalms. And our teachers kept that up through the war, making us memorize whole chapters from the Bible. And I can still, at my age of 82...
Yes, I can tell.
...still quote from many of the Bible passages that our teachers taught us, and these were what anchored us. Why would I think my daddy would ever tell a lie when he said, he shall give his angels charge over you to keep you? So we children, I was looking at the world as a child would look at it. God is going to take care of us. So I was not thinking about the rape of Nanking. I never heard of that until after the war.
Right. You mentioned, I think, about 1,400 or 1,500 people in the camp, the Weishien, is that how you say it?
Weishien.
Weishien camp. Give us an idea of sort of a visualization of what that looked like. What was it like to be in? How big was it? What was the area like? How were you confined? Was there, I believe there's barbed wire and electrified fences, is that correct?
This had been a Presbyterian missionary compound, and it was a walled compound, a campus with school buildings, a hospital, a church, And it had had a hospital and schools operated for the Chinese before the Japanese came, but the warring armies had taken it over, and it was a shambles by the time the prisoners got there. And all of a sudden, everyone was on his own. There were no servants. If there was food to be cooked, we were going to cook it. If there was water to be pumped, we were going to pump it. Every single person, except the smallest children, had a job, had jobs that they had to do. So everyone was now in a walled camp that had electrified wire atop it, and we would have daily roll calls. We all had to wear a prisoner number at all times. So you've got 1,500 people that are hungry, grown-ups scared of the Japanese. I don't remember being scared. I was scared of their dogs. They had Alsatian dogs, and I remember them with terror. I was terrified of the dogs. And they would patrol with the Japanese soldiers around the camp.
What was their attitude to the children, the Japanese soldiers and guards? Do they have, I mean, were they, nicer is probably not the right word, but did they have more time for the children? Was there any sympathy for the children, or was it, you know, sort of the same for everyone?
The Japanese seemed very much interested in the children, and sometimes they would even pull out pictures of their own children and show them to us. And we little girls, I was in what was called the lower school dormitory, the LSD. We were in a hospital dormitory room, and the Japanese guard box, one of the Japanese guard towers, was at the very close to where the hospital was. And we would go over there and signal. Of course, we couldn't speak Japanese, but sometimes we could speak enough Chinese, and they could speak enough Chinese that we could make our point. And we would desperately point that the ball had gone over the wall, accidentally gone over the wall. And when no one was looking, your Japanese guard would sometimes pull us little girls over the wall and down out into the fields beyond, where we'd search and search till we found the ball. And we'd have a few delicious moments of freedom until, when our teachers found out about that, they put a stop to that so fast that they said something could very serious happen either to us or to the Japanese who had done that. So there was a sense of kindness almost sometimes for us younger children in the camp. Now, grown-ups didn't feel the same way at all. If you talked to somebody else today that was a grown-up in the camp, they would tell you a completely different story.
Hmm. So the structure that the adults offered, obviously very important, and it gave a sort of a framework to operate the day around, I'm guessing. And that moves on to the brownies, the Jefu brownies, I think that's how you pronounce it. Yeah, I'm a former Boy Scout, so I know the value of this sort of stuff, but not in this context, obviously. Tell us about how the brownies group came together, and the guides and the rangers, and what sort of difference that made?
Well, in the very first concentration camp, we had a teacher called Miss Davy. She was our brown owl. That was the leader of our brownie troop. Hmm. And I can still tie the same knot. She taught reef and bow lane and round turn and two half hitches. I can still do those. I go out to my garden and can say, I can still do this. Miss Davy taught me this back in the 1940s. And we had all these things going on that made us feel safe. It was like a child is protected in their souls by a feeling of structure and predictability. And she created, and the teachers created, a comfortingly predictable environment. It's like a little voice on the inside says, oh, I know what's going to happen next. So you know if you were going to get up and do what we call the daily dozen. Those were exercises that someone had an old Victrola and played the Victrola, and we had an exercise for each song that was played. And we were working on badges, all these kinds of things. I can remember when we got to Weixian practicing the Morse code and practicing semaphore while we waited and waited and waited for the Japanese guards to come and do the actual count in our section of the concentration camp. Or we would practice such things as how to build a fire with maybe one or two matches. These were things that I think brownies around the world were probably learning to do, and girl guides. I remember earning a badge. I think it was called some kind of music, some kind of music, and it was I learned a Stephen Foster song, Way Down Upon the Swanee River, and so forth in the concentration camp to earn this badge for, I guess it was probably folk music, something like that. So that these kinds of things distracted us from the world, the fact of the world we were hungry, the fact of the world we didn't know when we were going to see our parents. I have to tell you, Paul, I did not see my parents for 5.5 years during the war. Wow. Did not see them. I was 7.5 when they left us at the School for Missionaries Children and did not see them until September 11, 1945.
Wow. So the adults were very purposefully creating an environment for you kids to operate as normally as you could in a very abnormal situation. That was a very conscious effort on their part, was it?
I'm sure it was. There were rituals every single day the same way. The teachers would come in up into our dormitory room, and we knew we all had to get up. It was the same every single day, and then we had teams of two, bless my soul. Marjorie Harrison and I can remember the victory of it. We were the one, the team that got the top potbelly stove red hot more times than any other team of two girls in our dormitory. I still remember that at the age of 82, that I was the best at getting the potbelly stove red hot. So these rituals every single day. I learned how to sew in the Chifu school, but we had sessions, inspections. Were we clean? Were we neat? Did we have our mending done every day? And if there were holes in our socks, we had to darn the socks. Who was going to, you weren't going to buy another pair of socks. There was no one to buy them from. You had to darn what you had. So there were these rituals, and the teacher said school will go on. So summer and winter, the teachers kept us going to school. And, you know, they sent such messages of hope. As a grown-up, I look at it and say, listen to this message. We will win the war, and when we get out of here, you will be competing with other boys and girls. That is an incredible message. Then there was the Salvation Army Band. The Salvation Army in the camp, the head was Brigadier Stranks, and he said, we will win this war, and when we do, we must have a victory medley. Now, he had sent the message around when everyone in Beijing was being rounded up to be brought to the Weixian concentration camp, and he said, we don't know how long we'll be there. Let's all take our musical instruments. We will need music while we're in this camp. So the Salvation Army Band, with their trumpets and all, a lot of them were teenage boys in our school, the Chifu school. They would practice the victory medley. They said, well, what should it be? They said, well, it ought to be the national anthems of whoever's going to find us and rescue us. So it could have been, we said, well, it could be China, it could be England, it could be Russia, it could be the United States. So they put those national anthems together and good hymns of the faith like Onward Christian Soldiers and, of course, a little American humor in there, Happy Days Are Here Again. And they would practice this outside the Japanese Commandant's office for the day that our liberators were going to come. What a message of hope. We were going to get out of this place and we were going to serenade the people that rescued us.
Do you think
that was a given in this camp?
Do you think the Japanese ever picked up on that?
They didn't, because the Salvation Army Band, they did not put the melody tune. They practiced the harmony.
Ah.
Maybe they hummed the melody while they played, but no, they did not. They would have, they were just practicing music. The Salvation Army Band played in religious services. One of the people who was in our camp was Eric Little, the famous British athlete who became famous with the movie Chariots of Fire, where he would not run on Sunday because it was against his religious principles. He himself had been born in China, the son of missionaries, and he was in the camp. We called him Uncle Eric. And he did all kinds of incredible. He was a saint. Uncle Eric was a saint.
Yeah.
He did so many things to keep life normal for us in the concentration camp. And the Salvation Army Band played under the window of the hospital the night before he died his favorite hymn, which was Be Still My Soul, The Lord Is On Thy Side. Finlandia is the classical music to that. And so the Salvation Army just was playing anyway around. So this was just the Victory Medley was just another of their songs.
Eric died in the camp, didn't he?
He did. And when he died, our school, we were the honor guard for Eric's funeral. And somebody in the camp, amazing, someone said at the memorial service that was held in the church that this was Jesus in running shoes. What a name.
Wow.
Jesus in running shoes. He taught the boys his favorite passage from Matthew, the Sermon on the Mount, and Jesus' words, "You must love your enemies and pray for those that despitefully use you and persecute you." Can you believe teaching that to teenage boys in a concentration camp?
It's incredible. How did he die? What were the circumstances?
I think it was a brain tumor. I'm not sure that anyone really knew. Right. It wasn't from any kind of persecution of the Japanese. I think he used to get these terrible headaches, and nobody, of course, obviously, there was no sophisticated medical or surgical equipment in the hospital, naturally, not in a concentration camp. And he died just a few months before the war was ended.
Let's talk about the rescue now. This is a remarkable story. This is seven individuals who I believe parachuted from a B-24 bomber and were up against, many more Japanese soldiers in the camp. What happened there?
Well, it was August 17, 1945, and it was a hot day. I was feeling sick with an upset stomach, and I was lying on the steamer trunks, and I thought I heard an airplane. Now, that couldn't be an airplane. We almost never heard airplanes coming over. And I kept getting louder and a rush to the window of our dormitory window. And there was this American plane coming low down, so low over the treetops, you could almost imagine you were seeing people inside the plane. And it was a bomber. And while I was watching, a parachute started falling out of the belly of this bomber. It had the blue American star on the wings on the underside of the wings. I've never seen parachutes before, but believe me, Mike, it was instant cure for my diarrhea. I jumped out. I said, "This must be people jumping out of this plane to rescue us." I said, "Out of 1,500 prisoners, I'm going to be the first one there to welcome whoever these people are. They're jumping out of this plane by these parachutes." When I got there, there were 1,499 people ahead of me. They'd gone out of their mind berserk, screaming, crying, dancing, waving at the sky at this plane that kept circling around, and more supplies, I guess, were dropping by parachute around. And the people of the camp just rushed, the men and boys, but just rushed out, even though the Japanese had their guns up, rushed out of the gate into the fields and out to these six Americans and a Japanese interpreter with them. And the men of the camp just picked up these heroes on their shoulders and carried them to the gate, carrying them back to the gates of the camp. And when they got to the gates of the camp, there was the Salvation Army band.
All right.
Victory medley up on a mound by the gate. And when they got to that part, "Oh, say, does that star-spangled banner still wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave?" A young American trombonist in the Salvation Army band, he just crumpled to the ground and began to weep, because we knew what everybody knew. We were free. The Japanese were going to be taken over, and they were. The Americans went into the camp and took over the concentration camp. And from that day on, American supplies began dropping down from the sky. Oh, my sakes, chewing gum, chocolate, Grape-A-Lade jam. We would pass the chewing gum from mouth to mouth because we didn't know when the next was coming. And we'd share it with the next person and the next person and the next person. And we little girls, well, the girls, all the girls were in love with every one of these gorgeous men, tanned with meat on their bones. We little kids wanted to sit on their laps. We wanted them to teach us the songs of America. I can still sing one of the songs they taught us. They said, "You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy." Well, there you go.
Nice version.
I can still. still sing You Are My Sunshine after all these years. And we just wanted pieces of their hair. We wanted their autographs. We wanted buttons. Well, we little kids got buttons, boring stuff. My sister was a teenage girl, and these men had not seen Caucasian women for a long time. So people like my sister, they got the neat stuff like their insignia, that kind of thing. But we just fell in love with them. We absolutely fell in love with them. But they began arranging for the evacuation of the camp. It was not quick because the guerrillas were fighting, the communists were fighting. There were different factions of Chinese still fighting beyond the gates of the camp, and they were blowing up the railroad. So it wasn't, you couldn't just walk people out of a concentration camp.
One of those seven men was, in fact, a Japanese-American who had been interned, I believe, for part of the war. He was there, I think, as an interpreter. So maybe you can quickly tell us about him, and then you seeking to find out where these people had got to later on.
Tad Nagaki was a Japanese-American born in America. He was not interned in a camp, but his fiancée and family had been interned in a Japanese concentration camp. And in 1997, I went on a search. I knew that I had lived a miracle. I now was grown up and had read about the atrocities that had happened around the world, certainly under the Japanese, under the Nazis, all around the world, millions and millions of people died in these camps. And I had survived, and I said, who were these people? We had their names. We all got their autographs. So we had an idea of at least who their names were and where they lived when they were dropping down to rescue us. And I thought, how will you go about finding them? And I started my search. A miracle. In 1 year, I found all six Americans. And I went on a pilgrimage around the United States. I said, you know what? It didn't feel right just to say thank you to them, each one over the telephone. And I said, I have to go and say thank you to each one face to face. So I went on a pilgrimage. It took me 2 years to do a pilgrimage across the United States. Each is unique. There was only one that graduated from college. They came from different parts of the United States, and I decided I would find a way to honor each one in a unique way, and I did that. I never thought that I would find the Chinese interpreter. His name was Wong. He was the youngest on the team. He was only 20 years old. And about 2 months ago, we called him Eddie Wong. His real Chinese name was Wong Cheng Han. Well, Cheng Han is not a common Chinese name, but Wong is extremely common. Among more than a billion people, yeah. How do you find someone named Wong? And I was reading my emails about 2 months ago, and here was an email that said, my name is Daniel Wong. I am the grandson of Eddie Wong, who liberated the Weixian concentration camp. I nearly fell out of my chair. I read it again. He sent pictures. He was a grandson. He said, my grandfather is well, alive and well, and here's his address, where he lives in China, and here are pictures of him. I could not believe it.
That's incredible.
I said to my daughter, I have to find out if this is a hoax.
Yeah.
I didn't want it to be a hoax, but my name is all over the Weixian website, the story of how I found my heroes, the American heroes. In the last sentence of an article I had written for the internet website was, I am still looking for Eddie Wong. And this young man, Daniel Wong, now on a visitor's visa in the United States, had looked up all the names his grandfather had ever told him about the concentration camp and his part in the liberation, and he came up with my name.
Incredible. Wow.
So I have to tell you, Paul, I had the unbelievable miracle opportunity about a month ago, after I had sent about 16 questions that I wanted him to answer, and he answered them. I knew the answers. I wanted to know if he knew the answers.
Okay.
And he did. And I had Chinese friends set me up in their living room with a speakerphone and a set of time. I'm going to call it 9 o'clock in the morning, which would be 9 o'clock at night when Mr. Wong would still be up, even though he's 90 years old now. And I talked with him on the telephone. And I still had a little bit of, is this for real? Is this for real? And I said, after we had talked for, I just said to him, I have only one question, Mr. Wong. Tell me your story. So here he is talking to me in English, and he's telling me the story. And he says, well, I said, we all loved all the people that liberated us. Did any girls love you?
What did he say?
He said, well, he said, there were two teenage girls. One was Betty Lambert, and the other, I can't remember her name. They taught me to dance in Weifan. I nearly fell out of my chair. Betty Lambert became a ballerina in her adult life later on in the world.
Gosh.
And here he is giving me the name of this teenager. And then he said, there was a Greek girl, I don't remember her name. She gave me an embroidery piece of parachute embroidered with the rescue scene, the B-24 bomber up in the sky on this piece of embroidery, and the seven parachutists all parachuting down, autographed with every one of the names in the order in which they autographed. I said, Mr. Wong, I have one just like that. Well, let me tell you something, Paul. I haven't told Mr. Wong yet. It's going to happen. Mary is going to go to China. I have to see Mr. Wong and say thank you to him face to face. He is the last living member of the rescue team. I never, never thought that in a million years that I would find a man called Eddie or Wong Chung Han. And I have found him, and it is my intention to visit him and say thank you to him face to face. I have lived a miracle. You know what the name of that airplane was that they parachuted from that liberated the camp?
What was it?
The Armored Angel. And he shall give his angels charge over you to keep you in all their ways. That was the Armored Angel.
That's amazing.
I think it is. I have lived a miracle.
That meeting is going to be incredible, isn't it?
It will be, absolutely.
There'll be so much emotion and so much.
Very much. I vowed to my. When I was in my Chinese friend's home, they helped me put the telephone call through because they call China all the time and say they said come to our living room and make the phone call, and I said to them, I'm not going to cry. I'm not going to cry. I tell you, when he said Betty Lambert, I was nearly shouting. I was so in disbelief. This man was telling me the names of teenage girls in the camp, for pity's sake.
It's amazing. I'm struggling not to tear up just listening to it, I got to say.
Just amazing. And the airplane is called the Armored Angel. That is just an astonishment. The Americans set up the repatriation, and we were flown out in early in September in a cargo plane, seated on top of heaps and heaps and heaps of these parachutes that had been dropping down to provide supplies for us. You know what? Even the ladies were wearing khaki underwear, khaki shorts, khaki everything, because the supplies, of course, were all being dropped from American military bases in the Orient. And so we didn't care. We were going to wear these khaki things. It didn't matter. It was American. If it was American, it was good. That was it. Just the amazing thing. And you know what? When I visited every one of these heroes, and I made a huge fuss. I was serving in the state legislature in New Jersey at the time when I found them all. And I made a huge fuss. I called the newspapers in their towns. And in every town where they were living, the newspapers ran stories about these heroes. And they had lived quiet lives. Most of them were retired by the time I found them and were living very quiet lives. And all of a sudden, they were spotlighted in the newspaper across the United States. And I was even invited to go to Tad Nagaki. That was the Japanese-American. His grandson, his only living relative, his grandsons invited me to come to his 90th birthday in Alliance, Nebraska. And I said, I will come if you promise you will let me tell the story to your family and all the neighbors. They had set up a beautiful town-wide birthday celebration in the country club. And I had the opportunity with Tad Nagaki sitting so I could just reach beyond the microphone and pat him on the shoulder and tell the story of how what he had gone through as a Japanese-American, discriminated against through the war because he was a Japanese-American, and yet he had volunteered for what could have been death missions behind Japanese lines because he could speak Japanese.
Yeah.
And he was on the rescue mission. And, I mean, what wonderful, unbelievable opportunities that have come to me as a result of finding these heroes and seeing who they are. And they all said the same thing. Mary, I'm not a hero. I just did what any American would have done. And, you know, there are people that say to me, Paul, America has no heroes anymore. And I said, I know their names.
Yeah, I know seven names, yeah.
Yep.
Gosh, you've got me sort of quite emotional listening to all of that, Mary.
It's an amazing story.
I got to ask you this question as he pulls himself together here. When you look back over that time, your life and those events of 70 years ago and your incarceration, I mean, where do you put that in the context of your life now at the age you're at?
Very, very important. First off, I'm asked frequently to tell this amazing story, whether it be school children, whether it be a senior citizens club, a church group. It's all over. From one side of the country to another, I've had the opportunity to tell. It is an amazing story. It is a story of faith. There's no question about it that faith kept us steady through this war, through our teachers teaching us faith, our parents teaching us faith. And, of course, the business of seeing people who will risk their lives for 1,500 prisoners they did not even know, they could have been shot out of the sky by Japanese marksmen as they parachuted down from that airplane. When I found Major Stanley Steiger, who led that mission, he told me about that. He said, I had to make the decision whether to try to land on a little landing strip not too far from the camp, maybe a few miles, or to parachute. And he said it was a windy day, but I chose the parachute, low flying, parachute drop, low flying, because he said there would be less loss of life if we had trouble from parachuting down than if they had booby-trapped the airstrip, and the plane would have gone down and all of us would have gone. And he said it was my choice to fly low and parachute out of that plane. Eddie Wong told me he had never parachuted out of a plane before.
Gosh.
When he jumped from that airplane, August 17, 1945. Can you believe that? Not once had he ever jumped out of an airplane to parachute before. Amazing. People risking their lives for people they did not even know, prisoners they didn't even know. I could never say enough thank yous to these heroes. Never enough thank yous.
I was talking to 82-year-old Mary Taylor Previty earlier today.